Welcome to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. I'm Kate Kopp, editor of the Maine Monitor. The Monitor is the nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to delivering high quality, investigative, and explanatory journalism to inform Mainers about issues impacting our state and to empower them to be engaged citizens. This program is a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor. This month, we're doing something special. I'm joined by Sawyer Loftus, an investigative reporter for Maine Focus, the investigative team at the Bangor Daily News. The Maine Monitor recently began partnering with Maine Focus to bring you more access to great investigative journalism throughout the state. Sawyer joins us today to talk about a story he has done in partnership with ProPublica, where he's a local reporting fellow. For the past year, Sawyer has been investigating issues with housing in Maine, focusing on evictions and foreclosures. You can read the stories for free at bangordailynews.com or on the mainmonitor.org. Sawyer's most recent story, published in mid-July, focuses on a wave of foreclosures on properties in Maine that were purchased with the help of the federal government as part of a federal mortgage program designed for first-time low-income homeowners. Sawyer, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah. So this was such a fascinating story about a program I had never heard anything about. But before we get to some of the questions I have about the story, can you just help us first understand what is this mortgage program and what is it designed to do?
Yeah, just to set the stage, you know, fundamentally, this program is designed to provide a pathway to homeownership for some of the poorest, most rural Americans in the country. This program is formally called the Section 502 Direct Loan Program, or it's also called the Single Family Direct Loan Program. And it's part of a suite of offerings that the USDA, specifically the United States Department of Agriculture, offers to help folks afford to own and purchase homes. In particular, like, this program is pretty old. It's been around since 1949. The Section 502 in its name is the specific section of the Housing Act of 1949 that created this program. And it's pretty different than a lot of the other loan programs the government offers. As it says in the name, this is a direct loan program. So in this instance, the federal government is acting as the lender, whereas most federal loans these days are what are called guaranteed loans. So the federal government is not the one actually doling out and acting as the lender. They're acting as a guarantor. So if the borrower falls behind or, you know, forecloses, the private lender will still get at least a portion of their money owed from the federal government.
Can you, so now, do these loans require any kind of down payment? And what do you have to do to qualify?
These loans are super interesting because the direct loan program is specifically targeted for low to very low income folks, again, in rural areas. And because of that, you do not have to have a down payment. These can be up to 100% financed, which is a really great way for people who otherwise would not have been able to afford a home to access home ownership.
Last year, for instance, how many of these loans did the USDA give out nationwide?
Yeah, in the previous fiscal year, the USDA gave out about 49,000 of these loans, and also loans through its partner program called the 502 Guaranteed Loan Program, which, as I mentioned earlier, is a little bit of a different function than a direct loan. And that program is, the Guaranteed Loan Program is not the one that the story focuses on, but it's good to mention because it serves a different audience. It serves folks who are low to middle income, whereas the direct program serves low to very low income. And it's a difference of where the money comes from.
Okay. Then this story focuses on this direct loan program.
So we're talking about, again, very low income folks who otherwise would not be able to afford home ownership.
Okay. Now, so this is, you know, I had never heard of this program before you wrote about it. I don't know that listeners will be necessarily familiar. How did you hear about this program and what made you start looking into this story?
Yeah, so this is one not a lot of folks initially know about, but it has a pretty rich history in the United States. As I mentioned before, you know, it's been around since 1949 and it's gone through a lot of iterations. It was originally designed for farmers, and is like broadened out into just rural homeowners now. But over the last year, as you mentioned, I've been working with ProPublica on stories about housing in the state of Maine. And so I have to take us back in time to almost 2 years ago when I was preparing to apply to that fellowship with ProPublica. I knew I wanted to write about federal housing programs in the state. I knew that there was probably going to be something about public housing. And then along the way, I just wanted to familiarize myself with as many federal programs as possible. So almost 2 years ago, I came across this program and a fact sheet related to it, and sort of put it in the back of my mind because I knew largely my project with ProPublica, I wanted to focus on rental housing, which the USDA does have another kind of program for that. So that's where it kind of started. And then it wasn't until April of this year that it sort of reappeared back in my brain. I was flipping through PACER, which is the federal court, like the digital federal court system, where you can see all the cases that are filed. And I noticed about a handful of cases were filed by the USDA against homeowners in Maine seeking to foreclose. And I thought, that's weird. I've never seen a case like this. I look at PACER every day, if not, you know, multiple times a day, always looking for stories. And or just interesting tidbits because I'm just like that as a person. But I noticed a handful and, you know, made a note to myself in my notebook and also started a spreadsheet where I was tracking these. And then that handful turned into a dozen and it just kept snowballing to the point where we were seeing 55 of these cases by May and June. And so that's where it started. I bugged my editors, so both my BDN editor and my ProPublica editor, and I said, "Hey, like I know this wasn't part of the plan with my fellowship, but I'm seeing this really weird thing happening in Maine's federal court system. I think we should look into it." And all the while, I started reading the cases. I started calling all my housing sources and, you know, asking them like, "Hey, have you guys heard about all these foreclosures being filed by the USDA of all agencies?" Because I think typically when we think of the USDA, we think of agriculture, and not housing programs. So that's where it started. And then I kind of just kept going and they gave me the green light, to keep pursuing it. And that brings us to early May when, while we were ramping up our reporting, the Press Herald published a really great story that offered a really like a first look at the issue and surveyed the cases and that, you know, essentially said like there's this weird thing happening in Maine's federal court. And so from there we definitely wanted to try to get to this question of like, well, why is this happening? Why is the USDA filing to foreclose on all these properties? Especially with the context that, you know, these properties were purchased under this special direct loan program that is meant for really poor people. And so we just kind of kept following and pulling the thread.
I love that you flip through PACER daily. That's a very investigative reporter thing to
It's a terrible habit. It's a
do.
terrible habit, but you know, there's always interesting stuff in there.
Yeah, it is. So you see this weird thing happening with these foreclosures that the USDA is filing. Now, tell us a little bit about what is supposed to happen if you, because I imagine you sometimes have homeowners, obviously, who can't pay their mortgage through this program. So what is supposed to happen when somebody gets a mortgage through this USDA direct loan program and can't pay their mortgage?
They have a kind of a small suite of tools that are called special servicing actions. So this is it's very wonky jargon, but for those of you who already have a mortgage, you might have heard of mortgage servicing. It's the act of like tending to the loan and overseeing the loan. And so these special servicing actions are all things the USDA is supposed to do as soon as a borrower shows signs of getting in trouble or asks for help. And those can include delinquency workout agreements. So it's basically a repayment plan that says, I know I'm behind on my mortgage, but let's work out a plan for, say, the next 2 years to pay back everything I owe and all the future installments as well. There's also things called protective advances, which are typically tied to like home maintenance with homes purchased through this program. So say the reason that you have fallen behind on your foreclosure is because there's a hole in your roof. You can get a protective advance to cover that, and you sort of repay that back over time as well. There's also payment assistance options, so additional subsidies that can reduce the interest rate. But again, just like all the other options, it comes kind of with this caveat that whatever you don't pay right now, you're still going to be on the hook for later. And then the kind of more frequent thing that we saw, or that people at least knew about when we were doing the reporting on this story, was this thing called a payment moratorium, which is essentially a pause on payments on these loans. However, the interest continues to accrue throughout that moratorium. So, you don't necessarily have to pay that principal down over time, but that bill is going to keep rising because whenever you take out a mortgage, you're not just taking the principal, you're getting the interest that's added on. Those are the main ways, but then there's some other ways too. But we can talk about that as we get further into the foreclosure process.
Yeah, well, so basically the government has all these ways to kind of help people who have fallen behind on these loans figure out how to get back on track. But so and the story has this, starts with a profile of this woman from Caribou who had one of these mortgages. And it sounds like basically none of those things happened in this case. So tell us about this woman from Caribou and how you found her.
I mean, so ideally, one lawyer I spoke to for this story kind of painted me this picture of what the gold standard is when anyone falls behind on a mortgage and is facing foreclosure. The gold standard remedy here is basically rewriting the mortgage, refinancing, so it would reduce the monthly payments. It might extend the loan term out further. But the bank is still getting paid, the lender is still getting paid, and you still get to live in your house. And then, more importantly, the bank doesn't have to go through the expensive process of filing a foreclosure. In the case of this Caribou woman, who we found through the cases, and ultimately her attorney, Tom Cox, put us in touch with her. And I had been actually speaking with him before he took on her case. He was feeling this out as well. He was like, kind of, he also came across this issue in Pacer and was like, hey, this is really weird. We had reached out to him because I had known previously he's done a lot of work with foreclosure cases, especially in 2008. And so he kind of spoke to us for his client, which is totally fine in a case like this. The lawyer is actually the one who typically has all the documents. He helped us understand this woman's situation by basically like relaying it through himself. But yeah, it dates back to 2012. She had become disabled and was no longer able to work. And so without a steady source of income other than her disability paycheck that comes from the government every month, the cost of just upkeeping the house, along with some major repair issues, like her basement flooded, the furnace stopped working. All of these are really costly repair items. On top of medical expenses, just made it unaffordable. And so what she did was she physically drove from her home in Caribou to a USDA office in Presque Isle, thinking there's staff there that can help me. These are the people I got my loan through. They definitely can help me. And she tried to hand over her keys, and they wouldn't take them. Instead, she was told that she had to call a toll-free number that was for this place called the Servicing Office, which is not based in Maine. It is the National Servicing Office for these mortgages, and it is based in St. Louis, Missouri. So once you sign one of these mortgages, all of your issues, any issues that come up with it, you have to go through this centralized servicing office in St. Louis. She tried to call and she didn't get anyone, and so she left a message and sort of just waited to hear back, and she really didn't. All she wanted them to do was take the home. She wanted to be done with it. She did not want to be involved with the home anymore. And so during those intervening years between when she eventually left the home, she abandoned the home that same year in 2012, because she couldn't afford it and she needed to live somewhere else. So she left her home, and it took until, April of this year for them to file for foreclosure. But during that period of time, they garnished her disability checks. The federal government did. This is one of the interesting features of a direct loan program, because the federal government is the lender. They have sort of extraordinary powers to tap into other sources of federal funding you may be receiving. It specifically is provided in federal law that they can garnish things like your Social Security disability check, which they did multiple times to offset her debt. They also wrote her a number of letters that informed her that she was imminently going to be foreclosed upon, which again was, the best case scenario for her. She wanted to be rid of this home, but still, they waited 13 years, and during that time, like her debt continued to accumulate because the interest continues to accumulate every day. They have tacked on some other fees that we'll definitely talk about in a little bit. But yeah, and so she, her fate has still not been determined yet. These cases are, most of them are still actively being litigated. And so there have been a handful which that are done. The case is closed, the folks defaulted. So in the court world, when you default on a case, it means typically means that you didn't answer the complaint. And so the USDA just gets to take the home now. And then there's a handful of there's a many of the cases have gone to the state's foreclosure mediation program to see if an agreement can be worked out. And then there's a really small subset of these cases where the homeowner has an attorney, such as this Caribou case, and those ones are in the beginning stages of being litigated.
Wow. So she, got this loan in the house in 2006, lived in it for 6 years, and then in 2012 tried to hand over the keys and just couldn't do it. Well, we have to take a quick break. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. This month, we're here with Sawyer Loftus, an investigative reporter with our partners at Maine Focus, the investigative team over at the Bangor Daily News. And we're talking about a story that Sawyer recently published alongside ProPublica on foreclosures in a USDA housing program in Maine. So now, I imagine maybe you can clear something up for me. Was the woman able to sell her house? Like, did she have was she allowed to sell the house? Like, why not just go and say, well, I'll sell it. I'll, transfer the mortgage to somebody else.
That is a great question, and it's one that we weren't really able to get a clear sense on. There's certainly a lot of regulations around what these folks can do with these properties. Selling it can be an option. It sort of is. It is unclear right now why that maybe was not the option here. But more importantly, there's a tool available to the USDA in their handbook that is called a deed in lieu of foreclosure, which is when you, the homeowner, voluntarily, give over the rights to the property to the lender. And it's really unclear why that didn't happen here. The USDA has in their guidebook this provision that says, you can take over and assume control of a property, and then we'll sell it ourselves and avoid a foreclosure proceeding. And it's again, it's really unclear why that didn't happen here, and it's kind of unfortunate that it didn't happen here, because the value of the home as it's sat empty has declined. And that is because the house was in a bit of a state of disrepair initially when she abandoned it, and those issues have continued to build up. The roof will likely need to be completely replaced, which is pretty costly. All the carpeting and flooring in the house has been ripped up. There are appliances missing. Tom Cox, her attorney, described to me as he was sort of walking through the house himself what he saw. And in one of the rooms in the corner, there looked to be what he believed was a pile of feces. And there's also been a number of times documented through police reports where squatters have overtaken the home. And so all this time over the last 13 years, it's sort of just deteriorated, and the value of the home, according to a real estate broker that Tom had brought in for his client, is around $40,000, which is a far cry from the several hundred thousand dollar bill the USDA is seeking her to pay.
And so she moves out of this house thinking, well, did you get any insight into why she moved out rather than sort of stay and wait for a resolution?
The furnace was no longer functional. So the home had no heating. And we're talking about a house up in Caribou, Maine, which it's going to get cold in the winter. So the safest option for her was to find somewhere with a reliable heating system. It, to her, seemed to be the cheaper option.
Okay, so she moves out of this house. 13 years later, she gets this, foreclosure notice. And you talked a little bit about the fact that there are additional fees associated with this, not just these mortgage payments and the interest. So what kind of money are we talking about here?
So in the actual complaints that are filed in federal court, so the document that is, the basis of the case, it sort of it re-breaks down those numbers just in three broad categories, which included the principal amount owed, accrued interest, and then this like big category of other fees. And so largely in most of these cases, what seemed to be like the driving cost was accrued interest, because again, as the unpaid principal balance just kind of sits there unpaid, it still is accumulating interest that will not stop and will not go away. And so that's where we saw, and especially in this Caribou woman's case, that price kind of increase. Additionally, these other fees have been a question, and they're not explained in the complaints. They're not explained in the letters that were sent before those cases were filed in federal court. And we reached out to the USDA multiple times asking them, what are these fees? Can you explain what these fees are? They didn't say anything. We asked the attorney that's working on this case for the USDA what these fees are. He also declined to comment. There is a thing within the USDA's 502 direct loan program called preservation. There are these things called preservation fees, and there's sort of an allowable table of them, and they typically are about physically preserving the property. So that's things like mowing the lawn, making sure the house does not fall apart as it kind of sits there. But it's, again, especially with this case in Caribou, it's kind of unclear. This woman's been charged preservation and inspection fees, but it's extremely unclear what has been preserved, especially because the house is in such a state of disrepair.
Wow. Okay. So really no clarity into what other other fees are. Now, you mentioned that there have been this wave of what, 55, 56 sort of.
56 in total have been 56 of these foreclosure cases specifically have been filed across the
Okay.
entire country, but 55 are in Maine. So
But 50,
one has
okay.
been filed in one other state, and that was the state of Vermont.
And so this program's been around for a long time, though. What did the numbers look like in previous years? What's this big jump about?
Yeah, I mean, so in previous years too, it's important to note that the USDA typically filed these cases in any given state's state court system, which is a kind of different beast when it comes to tracking. In the state of Maine, we are still largely a paper-based court system, so it's really hard to get firm numbers, but I spoke briefly to the attorney that used to do this work for the USDA, and he described the kind of pacing of filings as pretty regular up until just before the COVID-19 pandemic, when it sort of slowed down a bit. But again, never the volume of 55 cases filed within the span of a month. Usually a few every month here and there. That kept him, pretty busy, regularly busy, but again, not 55 seemingly almost all at once. So that's definitely been a change. And then the one thing the USDA did say to us throughout the reporting process was that in total, they were looking at 400 homes in Maine alone that were facing foreclosure that have mortgages through this program. Now they did not clarify when we asked them, well, are there 55 less from that 400 number because you filed 55 cases? So we don't know if that 400 number means there's 400 more. But this is definitely, not an isolated issue to 55 cases.
So if the state has a, well, mostly sort of, paper-based court system, were you able to get any understanding of the number over the years, apart from talking to this attorney who'd done this work?
We definitely tried. We looked at what was available online, and I went to the Penobscot County's courthouse to look through their records to see. And it was pretty hard to glean from those records. But we also took a peek at the federal government's database of contracts, because they for these cases in particular, they don't actually use federal prosecutors or the folks who are in the Department of Justice to go after these cases. They typically contract it out to a private attorney. And so we were able to look at contracts from 2012 to 2022, and there were probably maybe 100 or so contracts for foreclosure related services in the state of Maine. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean every contract was for a foreclosure, because there's lots of things that go into a foreclosure. There's the actual court proceeding, and then outside of that, if the federal government wins the case, there's the selling of a foreclosed home, which happens through a very particular process. So there were about 100 or so entries, all with the same law firm that is not doing the cases now. But this previous law firm seemed to be the only person doing it from 2012 to 2022. And so again, even if you look at the years of those contracts, we're not seeing like 55 contracts in any one year either. So it definitely kind of stood out as an anomaly, at least when we all, and the team that was reporting this with me, looked at this.
And I remember reading the story. You said the USDA does not publicly report how many of these it files, correct?
Correct. That is our understanding, and that is the understanding of experts at the national level who have been watching this program for years. And in fact, that's why, one of Maine's members of Congress, Representative Shelley Pingree, has proposed language in the report attached to the USDA's budget for the upcoming for this next round of budgeting that's happening at the federal level. There's language in a report that would require the USDA to disclose to the subcommittee she sits on that oversees the USDA the number of foreclosures, the number of abandoned and vacant homes attached to this program, because it would seem that members of Congress also don't know. What we were able to figure out was that, in terms of delinquent payments, which is the step right before you fall into what's called default. So default is sort of this point of no return. That is when the foreclosure process like officially kind of triggers. But right before then, there's this term called delinquent, which in the USDA world, I believe the handbook states that you are 90 days past due on a payment. We were able to obtain data from inside the USDA that was not public, that showed this sort of landscape of how many of their active 502 direct loans were considered delinquent. And it was nearly a fifth across the entire
Wow.
country, which Maine certainly does not make up in any logical world a fifth of all these mortgages in the country. So it definitely is an issue that extends beyond Maine.
Wow. A fifth were delinquent. Now, you mentioned that these cases were now being filed in the federal court system, which is how you found them initially. Do you understand why they moved from the state system to the federal system?
Again, that's a really great question, and it's one that we asked the USDA. I in fact sent probably a dozen emails to the USDA with the same list of a bulleted list of questions that remained unanswered that they still to this day have not answered, and that was one of them. But I'll say, the folks that we talked to that are lawyers that have done foreclosure work in the state of Maine and across the country have sort of speculated that it's simply easier to track, even for the federal government. All that stuff is right in PACER, and you can see it across the entire country. That's one possible avenue. It's also possible that they thought that the process might be different in federal court, because in the state of Maine, there is a pretty standard process for a foreclosure, which would include, if the case is eligible, diverting it to a mediation program, which can delay the process, but that mediation program like still happens at the with federal cases. The federal court will literally refer the cases to the state court's foreclosure mediation program, which has happened in a number of these cases. So it is one of those lingering questions, especially given that you're not seeing attorneys from the Department of Justice as the attorneys going after these cases, which again is not unusual in the realm of these USDA foreclosure cases, but you will see more commonly in federal court foreclosure cases that are filed by a member of the Department of Justice that are associated with like an unpaid tax lien that came as a result of a criminal offense or judgment. So again, it's like it's part of this like kind of grand mystery here that the USDA has just not they've just not said anything on about, which was kind of unusual. Like you sometimes as a reporter, when you reach out to especially an entity like the USDA, expect them to say something, to provide some sort of statement that either tries to provide clarity or pivot away from the issue. But in this case, it was just silence. We got one statement from the USDA in early May, and that was it. They never responded.
Wow, it sounds like a very opaque system. Then and so pretty, it's hard to report on things if you have basically no cooperation from the federal agency that you're trying to report on. So let's, maybe go back a little bit to this woman in Caribou and some of the other folks that you found. So you have these court documents from PACER, and their names are in there, presumably, right? These are not redacted documents. The names are in there, so you can see. How, what did you do from there, and who else? Tell us about some of the other stories that you found.
Yeah, we ended up visiting about a dozen of these properties because the address is central to this case, so it's listed in the court documents. In the federal court system, that information is not considered private. And so myself and two other folks here at the BDN kind of split up the properties that were in our immediate coverage area. We had someone that was already up in Aroostook County visit a handful of these homes, and then I visited a handful that were kind of more in the closer Bangor area. And then we had our reporter in Belfast go to the ones that were in that area. And in my experience specifically, I went to probably about, I think it was like four or five of these homes. And there was one in Glenburn we went to, there was one in Dexter. We went to one in Norridgewock, we went to one in Winslow. And it was kind of a, it was a mixed bag of what you got. For example, I mean, there's two main categories that I would put these homes in. They're either occupied or unoccupied. So in our case, in the cases that we, actively followed up on and went to in person, about, I think it was around five of the 12 homes appeared abandoned. It's impossible to tell if a home is abandoned, but there are certainly signs. And so with those homes, there was typically a sign in the window or on the door that said the home was being cared for by a property that was based out of Brooklyn, or a company that was based out of Brooklyn, New York, that has previously done work for the federal government in terms of like caring for property. So that to me was a sign that the home was abandoned. You have someone else taking care of it. Additionally, most of these homes were in a bit of a state of disrepair. So we're talking like broken out windows, boarded up windows, dust and cobwebs covering doors. For instance, this one home I went to in Dexter, it was kind of puzzling because when we drove by at one time, our photographer and I, we drove by at one time, and we were like, is this the right house? Because it looked just like a nice normal house. It was a small little square house, and the had a sort of gravel driveway that was still maintained. Like there weren't really weeds sticking up out of it too much. The grass had been mowed leading up to the front door, and when you looked at the house, it just looked like no one was home until you kind of got a little closer. I peeked into the house, and it was empty. There was nothing in there. But sort of like you just turn immediately to the right of the house and you see the grass is, well up to my knees. There was an old Dodge pickup truck that was just sitting there, kind of rusting into the ground with the next to this red shed that the paint had been so worn away that you could kind of see that like the gray hue that lumber turns when it's been exposed to weather. So it was kind of clear that like no one had been there for a while. And in fact, the USDA's attorney did have to file this an extra filing in court to say that one of the two homeowners was dead. So one of the homeowners was dead, and the other one like no longer lived at the property. So that one was completely abandoned. And then there's this woman, Christine Ogden, who's quoted in the story. She fits into that other category of, she still is living in the home. I like it was always a bit, it's always a bit nerve-wracking when you have to go door knocking as a reporter. But I actually found in some of these cases, like this one woman I spoke to in Dover, Foxcroft, she had not even formally been served with the paperwork yet that said, you've got to show up and respond to this in court. She knew that there was a federal court case against her, but she had not actively been served yet. So I was a bit of a bearer of bad news.
So you had to explain to her what was, well, what was that like?
I mean, it sadly is not the first time that that has happened. There is a bit of a delay when someone files a court case, from when they file the court case and it becomes public to when you actually, as a defendant in a court case, get handed the paperwork that says you got to respond to this. You're being sued in federal court or state court. But it definitely, it was difficult, because, as the woman explained to me, she lived there most of her adult life, and she had fallen on difficult times financially, and was just struggling to get by in general. She was an older woman who recently stopped working because she became disabled, and so no longer had the ability to continue working. So her finances fundamentally changed, and she kind of felt like that just didn't matter to the USDA. She was definitely nice enough to chat with, but she was not one of those folks that made it in the story, simply because she didn't want to be. But yeah.
Well, and you, so you mentioned, this other woman, Christine Ogden. Tell us a little bit about her case.
Yeah, she her house is in she lives in Searsport, and she's lived in this house since the mid-90s. She raised her two kids in this house, and she, had purchased this home through this program, like with this mortgage, with the idea that it was, as she told me, like always going to be affordable. That was what was kind of billed to her. And when you look up information about this program, it the word affordable appears all over the place. The whole point of this is to be affordable. But kind of a little more than a decade into it, she said that the amount of money she owed every month inexplicably changed. And she just struggled to continue paying, and fell into default, which is, that step that's right before they file that case against you in federal or state court for foreclosure. And she kind of lived in that world for, similar to the Caribou woman, like more than a decade, waiting for the federal government just to file the court paperwork to take the home away from her. And so when I spoke to her, I asked her if this came as a shock or a surprise, and she said no, she'd been expecting this for a really long time. It didn't change the fact that it still stung and hurt and was scary, but like she had been expecting it, because at that point she felt like her debt was so insurmountable that there was no way for her to continue paying it. And she was also extremely unclear on what she owed and what she didn't owe. And so her case is still being litigated as well. She has an attorney. But yeah, it's an interesting situation where, again, a lot of these cases, on the average, we found when we looked at all of them, was that on average, these cases had been in default for 9 years before a case was filed in federal court or state court against these homes. And I think that it's kind of important to distinguish here that, like, those 9 years, that's a choice. There's, really the only federal requirement around when you can file a foreclosure is, typically within the homeowner has to be within 120 days of default. You cannot file it any sooner, typically, and that's prescribed in federal law. Again, it's typically, there are some other instances, but in general, 120-day minimum. And then the foreclosure process itself, like, varies from state to state in terms of the timeline. And so, I mean, again, like, there's just a the more I looked at this story, we struggled to find any sort of like reasonable explanation as to why this has taken so long. And again, why all of a sudden now these cases were, or these houses were, being foreclosed upon, and these people who had lived in these homes for an extended period of time under this sort of assumption that, well, I guess I don't have to pay because they haven't come and taken the home yet. It creates this really puzzling situation that not only affects the homeowners, the debts that a lot of these people have racked up or are facing having to pay are insurmountable because again, the program is designed for low to very low income folks in the most rural parts of the country. And it leaves them with fairly limited options. The federal government is likely not going to see the return on this. They've let these things kind of sit there and fester for so long that the amount of money that people owe far outweighs the value of the homes. So the government is probably not going to recoup the cost that it's seeking.
Need to take another quick break. Here, if you're just joining us, you're listening to the Main Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. This month, we're here with Sawyer Loftus, an investigative reporter with our partners at Main Focus, the investigative team at the Bangor Daily News, to discuss a story Sawyer recently published with ProPublica on foreclosures in Maine. So coming back to this, you were just mentioning options. So were you able to find anyone whose home had been foreclosed on through this program and see what had happened to them?
We haven't yet because this was, this was so fresh that in some of the cases they had not been litigated all the way through. There have been a few that have officially kind of the case has been closed because they didn't respond, and I've tried to track down those people, but they also. And again, maybe they don't live there, but I've tried to track down those people and haven't been able to find them yet. But the majority of the cases are still open and ongoing. And so, there is this opportunity here to like watch in real time how this happens and what happens to these people. So that would be one thing I would say, we'll kind of stay tuned for because we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. The federal government at any point could stop this. They could dismiss the cases by themselves, or folks with attorneys can successfully argue that that perhaps the foreclosure shouldn't go through. So it's really, and I mean, this is one of the most frustrating parts for the homeowners here is this sort of waiting game of what's going to happen.
And do you know whether any of these have court dates cut yet, or is any of this scheduled?
So the ones that have all been diverted to the state's foreclosure diversion program are all kind of in the process of that. Like they are actively, there's active negotiations going on around that. But there's not yet been for the ones where the homeowners have hired an attorney. Those ones have not yet had a trial date set. They're still in this sort of negotiation phase between the two different attorneys, seeing like what can we do to solve this issue. But there's a great deal that has to happen in any sort of federal case before it goes to trial, so it'll be some time. But I wouldn't expect those ones to go to trial until probably mid next year at the earliest. So again, like we're still in this waiting game, and like these people are going to continue to live in this sort of like limbo status of like what is going to happen to my home. The foreclosure process, especially in Maine, is not an overnight process. It takes time to be litigated, but during that time, the debt still continues to accumulate. And so the interest continues to accrue. And you can see that even the USDA's attorney sort of warns of that in the complaints. Depending on each individual case's fixed interest rate, he had calculated a daily amount that the interest would continue to accrue in. And so that kind of stays true through to the end of the case. So These dollar values we're talking about are certainly just a starting point,
Wow.
in terms of what these folks could owe.
Yeah, I mean that 40, you said for around $40,000 for the woman in Caribou, and then the 400,000, right, was the sort of final figure with all of that. That is
Which, I mean, again, could go up. So yeah, her home is
right.
valued at, she purchased the home, this Caribou woman purchased the home for $144,000. The current value of it is $40,000, and the federal government claims that she owes $393,463.
Wow.
And again, that will continue to kind of build as the case progresses because interest continues to accumulate.
Wow. Well, we're nearing the end of our time here, but before we go, I want you to talk a little bit about, actually, I want to go back a little bit, and I want to talk about this office in St. Louis that you mentioned at the very beginning. So, as the story says, as these foreclosures kind of accumulate in Maine in the past couple of months, the USDA publishes this advisory, and it directs people, these borrowers, to call this same St. Louis office that was supposed to process these other cases for help. Tell us, how did we wind up sending people to an office in St. Louis for help with their loans in Maine?
Yeah, we have to go back to the 1990s. And in the 1990s, there was a huge restructuring of the USDA and which office within the USDA oversees these mortgages. It used to be under this agency called this sub kind of department agency called the Farmers Home Administration that I think I mentioned earlier. And then in 1993, this report came out from the Government Accountability Office that said, you guys need to centralize the administration of this specific loan program to get in line with what private lenders are doing across the world. They estimated that centralizing into one servicing office would result in a lower delinquency rate. Specifically, an internal survey that is cited by this GAO report estimated it to be the centralization's effort would reduce delinquent payment status to only about 10% of the loans, and it was at, I believe, 13 at the time. And so, starting in 1994, they continued forward with this effort to centralize. And so, prior to that point in time, there were a bunch of these offices that oversaw these loans scattered throughout the country typically at the county level. And so with this restructuring, it went to this St. Louis office or this one centralized office that's kind of bounced around a little bit, but it's typically been located in the St. Louis area because the sort of thinking at the time, based on some of the press materials I was reading from the USDA back in the early 2000s to mid 2010s was that St. Louis is sort of like the exact middle place in the country, and they wanted the servicing office for these loans to be in the middle, like physically, geographically in the middle of the office or in the middle of the country. So I mean, there's not like a very clear cut reason as to why St. Louis, but what is clear was that the government office that's in charge of evaluating and seeing how programs are functioning said, you guys really need to centralize this program. And they did. And the state offices lost the ability to oversee these loans. In the past, the county offices that I mentioned would do everything. They were the people that you met with to sign the mortgage paperwork. And then if you ran into a problem, they were the folks that you would turn to and talk to. But now, and this is very clearly spelled out in the USDA's handbook governing this program, you still sign your paperwork with folks in the state that you're in the state office. But once you sign that paperwork and your loan shifts to this active status, everything has to go through this centralized office in St. Louis. And as you mentioned, There's been some changes in the federal workforce as of late. We know that we obtained data that showed the number of folks who had taken the deferred resi that were part of the deferred resignation program, so the buyouts that the Trump administration offered to slim down the federal workforce. We obtained data that showed that as of early May, about 1,500 employees, which represents nearly a third of the Rural Development Office, which is the big office that this program is nestled under, had taken that buyout. And specifically, of those 1,500, about 197 worked in the St. Louis office. So again, we ran those numbers by the USDA and asked, what does this mean? And it was one of those things where we did not get an answer. But you can kind of infer here that there's some reduced staffing numbers. So we'll see. And certainly folks we spoke to that are very familiar with this program and the operations of this program mentioned that even before these buyouts happened, the centralized servicing office had kind of always been understaffed. Now, we weren't able to find any sort of specific proof of that in a report or anything, but enough people said it to us that we wanted to look into if these buyouts would affect that.
Well, clearly there is much more for you to keep reporting on. But thank you so much for sharing all of this with us. It's a fascinating story for those of you who haven't read it. Again, you can find it at thebangordailynews.com, or you can find it on our website at themainmonitor.org. Look out for the follow-ups in the future. And yeah, thank you so much, Sawyer, for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having
Yeah.
me.
You've been listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, a nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We were joined today by investigative reporter Sawyer Loftus. You can read all of his work at the Bangor Daily News and some of it at themainmonitor.org as well, and in newspapers around the state. Questions or comments related to the radio program can be sent to news@weru.org. If you have stories you want to share with us, you can find our emails at themainmonitor.org.